Hi, I'm Gabrielle Jackson, Associate Editor of Audio and Visual at Guardian Australia. Before we get into today's episode of Full Story, I want to tell you about The Guardian's newest podcast, Australia Reads. I'm really excited for you to listen to this podcast because it's a fabulous way for you to enjoy our best journalism. In each episode, one of our editors introduces you to a piece they've chosen. You'll hear some very familiar voices, including our editor Lenore Taylor and head of news Mike Tisha, who you know from this very show, the newsroom edition of Full Story. And you'll hear from many other of our acclaimed editors and journalists. We'll then read the piece aloud for you. There are three episodes every week, making sure you stay on top of our best stories. Look for Australia Reads on whatever device you're listening to right now. Okay, now for the show. This is the Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. Labor's Andrew Leigh has called JobKeeper the greatest smash-and-grab raid on public finances in Australian history.
There's one rule for robo-debt recipients, and then there is a completely different rule for the private equity firms, the hedge funds, the exclusive men's-only clubs, the cashed-up firms that took taxpayer handouts and saw increased earnings.
The scheme, which was designed to support business during the coronavirus pandemic and keep workers employed, has come under more and more scrutiny. We now know that $13 billion went to businesses that actually increased their revenue during the pandemic. And while the Morrison government continually refuses to claw back funds from these profitable businesses, they're still chasing nearly 12,000 individual people over debts caused by alleged welfare overpayments. Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Head of News Mike Tisha about the need for transparency in the government's JobKeeper program. It's Friday, the 10th of September. Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Gabs.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Lenore, for months now, we've had revelation after revelation about the JobKeeper program. What are the main facts people need to know now about this program?
Okay, so you need to dial back to the beginning of last year when COVID is hitting and the economy is tanking and there are queues of unemployed people around the block and the government is thinking, what the hell do we do? They devised this scheme which paid companies $1,500 a fortnight for each employee, so the workers stayed on the payroll, and it kind of kept the economy kind of in deep freeze, if you like, until we figured what to do about the pandemic. And in the broad, I think it was a really, really good an idea. It wasn't an idea that would have come naturally to the Liberal Party. And of course, it was conceived in a hurry because of the circumstances. But in the broad, I think it was the right thing for the government to do. But it had these mistakes embedded into it. In its first iteration, companies got the money either by showing a decline in their turnover of at least 30% or by forecasting a decline in their turnover of 30%. And of course, in that circumstance, it's really hard to forecast what's going to happen. So companies, through no fault, through no ill will, were getting that forecast wrong. And there was nothing in the legislation requiring them to pay back the money if it turned out that they didn't need it. And it's that kind of mistake, I think it's a mistake, embedded in the legislation, which is kind of causing all the problems.
And Mike, there are a lot of figures floating around about the number of companies and how much money companies who actually increased turnover received.
Yeah, so I think we've become a bit inured to how much money we're actually talking about since the pandemic has thrown what used to be, you know, normal budget calculations completely out of whack. But from what we know, $25 billion out of the total of $89 billion that the government spent on JobKeeper went to companies whose turnover, in fact, either increased over one or both of the two quarters or did not decrease by enough to make them qualify for it in, you know, in theory, except they did qualify for it because all they had to do was predict whether it would happen or not. If that did not happen, there was no obligation on them to pay it back.
This program ended in March. It's now September, and there are still stories every week coming out about the JobKeeper program. Why won't this story go away, Lenore?
I think because the inequity of it is so gobsmacking, because the amounts of money are so gobsmacking, and because it really sticks in people's craw that there is no transparency at all around the scheme, and we're just getting dribs and drabs of information about what companies got it and what their profits were and, you know, whether their turnover went up or not. The Australian Securities and Investment Commission required that listed firms disclose to shareholders and the public how much JobKeeper they received. That wasn't actually part of the design of the scheme. It happened after JobKeeper legislation passed Parliament. But that is the only actual information that we definitely will get. And that means it's only for Australian listed companies. It's not for private companies. It's not for foreign controlled companies or charities or not-for-profits. And the consultancy firm Ownership Matters calculates that those companies only account for about 3% of JobKeeper payments. So we don't know anything at all about the other 97%. And of course, you know, sleuth-like journalists and people who are concerned about the inequities of this are persisting with investigations into it. And so we get more, you know, drip-fed revelations about what companies got it, how much they got, how much their profits went up, what bonuses they paid to their executives, et cetera, et cetera. And gradually, I think anger is building as that information comes out.
Well, I think the transparency issue is really important. We'll come back to that. But I just wanted to ask you first, Mike, about the inequities and about the comparisons that are being constantly made to JobSeeker and RoboDebt and how the government is claiming back some debt from welfare recipients, but not clawing back this debt from big companies that are profitable.
Mm. So I think first we need to just dwell a little bit on how much money we're talking about and what a colossal part of the budget that would be. At the last budget, the government promised to spend $15.2 billion over 10 years on its infrastructure commitments. It promised $13.2 billion extra for the National Disability Insurance Scheme. It promised $17.7 billion to overhaul the aged care system. These were like some of its big ticket items in the budget. Mm. We're talking about $25 billion that have been lost to the budget. It's a huge amount of money. Labor's plans are for $10 billion for a social housing over 5 years. These are like major budget items, and they would be all comfortably covered by the $25 billion that has been lost. So that's the first point. It's vast. And obviously, I'm sure listeners could think of very many other areas where that amount of money could be well spent. And on the inequity point, just to go specifically to RoboDebt, that project was purported to be clawing back $3 billion. That was what the government claimed the RoboDebt program would do. As we know, they had to end up promising to pay back 470,000 debts to 373,000 people at a cost of $721 million. So, you know, they were the sort of sums that we were arguing over and quibbling over with welfare recipients. And yeah, it's just massively dwarfed by this amount.
But there's also the direct inequity within JobKeeper. So as we revealed last month, the federal government sent out more than 11,000 debt letters to Centrelink recipients worth a total of $32 million, claiming that these were people who were overpaid JobKeeper.
Mm.
And they're going after those people who made genuine mistakes. They're pursuing them, like the woman who was on 60 Minutes last week who overestimated her income and she owes $1,000 and she has to pay it back. So the government is pursuing those individual JobKeeper debts. But if a company overestimated how much its revenue would decline and got millions and millions more than they were entitled to through JobKeeper, they don't have to pay back anything because the law doesn't require it. So there's a really direct equity comparison between companies and individuals within JobKeeper itself.
Mm. And that woman is paying back $15 a fortnight out of her $650 part pension. So, I mean, that's the kind of scrimping and saving we're talking about on that level, whereas for the companies, they can pay their executives their bonuses, they can pay their shareholders dividends out of the benefit of the JobKeeper. So, yeah, it is a massive inequity.
Josh Frydenberg has, you know, said to our political editor, Catherine Murphy, that that was an unfair comparison.
Should they pay back JobKeeper? Absolutely. If they're in the if they've got the ability to pay it back, they should.
Well, why not make them?
Because we don't retrospectively change tax laws.
But you claw back, you know, debt from welfare recipients, yeah, and
I think that's I really do feel like that's a false analogy, because one is in a.
How did he justify that, Lenore?
So it's the most ridiculous secular argument you've ever heard. So basically, what he says is that because the law requires the government to go after individual recipients, so because it is actually against the law, it's different from companies because the law doesn't require the government to go after them, which is kind of answering the question with the question. That is the whole problem. The law is an ass in the case of companies and JobKeeper. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, the other argument he uses, which I think is equally spurious, is that had they put in some kind of clawback provision at the beginning, companies wouldn't have applied for the money.
Why didn't you include a clawback feature in the original JobKeeper plan?
If we'd gone for a percentage of a person's income or we'd gone for an actual decline in turnover, we wouldn't have got the money out the door. And
I mean, I just think that's a really silly argument. You could have put in a clawback provision with a big buffer in it so that companies weren't, you know, worried that they'd end up just on the line and have to pay something back. But surely if a company knew at the outset that their profits were going to double or treble, that they were not going to suffer at all, then they would know that in that eventuality they would be happy to pay it back. You know, like it was just a security clause, I guess, for the worst case scenario. And I just don't buy the idea that if there was a clawback provision in the event of, you know, super profits, that companies would not have applied for it in the first place. I think that's also kind of ridiculous.
Mm. Some of the language they've used around these various, they seem to have tried out three or four different arguments around this. And some of the language has been kind of shocking, I think. I mean, Scott Morrison in February was asked about it. He said, whether they should pay it back. He said, I'm not into the politics of envy. He described it as an envy narrative to suggest that companies should pay back money that, you know, when they had in fact made profits or not large losses. Josh Frydenberg's talked about it being a smear on confidentiality within the taxation system to even name the companies who've received JobKeeper. So I don't sense that is really going to wash well with the public.
And there was no problem in terms of confidentiality in New Zealand and the UK and other countries where the similar sorts of programs did come with a transparency requirement. So I don't see why we are in any way different.
Yeah, I want to talk about transparency now because, as you say, Lenore, the Canada, the US, UK, New Zealand all had transparency clauses in their schemes, in their similar schemes. We're the only one who didn't. What is their defence against transparency in the program?
Well, they don't really have one. And, you know, to just sort of wind back a step, I actually think starting from where we are now, transparency is the best possible remedy that we have. Mm. I don't think that it's reasonable to retrospectively install some sort of mandatory clawback mechanism. I don't think you can do that retrospectively. But most of the companies that have paid back JobKeeper that they got when they didn't need it did so because of the public opprobrium, because of the reputational risk or detriment they were suffering when people found out that they had received these great wallops of money that they didn't need. And so a transparency register, I think, would put more companies in that situation and would result in more money being paid back, which I think is a desirable public policy outcome. The government said they can't possibly do that because it would somehow violate the sort of secrecy provisions or confidentiality provisions of the tax office. I just don't think that washes. You know, nobody's asking for all of a company's tax data. It's just what they received in JobKeeper so we can compare it against publicly available information about profitability.
And Rex Patrick did try to introduce a clause to have some transparency. What was all that about, Lenore? Can you just remind listeners what happened there?
In the Senate, the independent Senator Rex Patrick tried to move an amendment to other legislation to require the ATO to reveal companies with an annual turnover of more than $10 million that had received JobKeeper, and it looked like that might actually go through. And then at the last minute, One Nation flipped and they only required it for companies who were going to have to do it anyway because of the ASIC requirement. So it was actually rendered meaningless because the government sort of got to One Nation. Now Rex Patrick's threatening not to deal with the government on other legislation.
I'll show you what Rex Patrick's just tweeted. One of the crossbench senators is pushing hard on this. He's just tweeted this. I'm done with them. Scott Morrison gifting hard-earned taxpayers' money to his business mates and donors makes him the most shameless and unethical PM ever. Josh Frydenberg's prudential failure makes him the most incompetent treasurer ever.
And the Senate crossbench is still pushing the tax office boss, Chris Jordan, to hand over that list of companies. And he's claiming public interest immunity. And Rex Patrick is asking the Senate to launch contempt proceedings against Chris Jordan. So it's all getting a bit willing. Mm. I don't know that actually they're going to be able to force the release of that information through parliamentary procedure. I think the most likely way that it will come out is through public pressure. Pressure from voters, from just public opinion.
Yeah, and we should make clear that the publicly listed companies who have to provide the data only account for 3% of the entire JobKeeper money that was given out. So we're talking about the vast majority of it.
Mm. And we've seen that transparency works, as you said, Lenore, in that case. Harvey Norman was a classic example of eventually relenting to public pressure.
Yeah, and the companies that have given it back are sort of making virtuous statements and saying it was the right thing to do, which I think it is. But, you know, clearly they see it as a sort of a public relations advantage from their point of view.
So, Mike, how is Labor handling this issue?
Yeah, so there's one problem for Labor, I think, which is that they have never been opposed to the JobKeeper scheme per se. In fact, they proposed something similar before it was implemented and the government at the time rejected it before quickly backtracking. Labor supported it while its operation, and they've repeatedly called for it to come back since it was being discontinued. So JobKeeper itself, they are not going to, you know, be campaigning against, but they just have to separate out the problem of the transparency, or, you know, whether companies should be made to pay it back or whether they can be shamed into paying it back. They have to separate out the transparency and the unfairness elements that we've just discussed. So that is a bit of a problem, and I think that may explain why a lot of this has been left to Andrew Lee rather than other more, you know, senior ministers and Anthony Albanese. But I don't really see why they can't, you know, the public are smart enough to understand the difference between the scheme as it was introduced and the problems that came with it that could now be rectified.
So we know from the reaction of our readers that this policy doesn't really sit well with voters or their response to the policy, but the government has remained pretty steadfast. What's their strategy, Lenore?
I think they're trying to wait it out. I think this is going to be an interesting test case about how possible it is for a government to just sort of weather and wait out, you know, what is obviously a public policy mistake, and not have to rectify it. And we're in a kind of war of attrition where, you know, the media is kind of united really in a way that is unusual in condemning it. So, you know, you've got us and the Nine newspapers and a lot of quite conservative columnists like Judith Sloan all really talking the same argument really about how inequitable and what a waste of money it is, and talking up the need for transparency. You've got the politicians, determined politicians like Andrew Lee and Rex Patrick, trying to force change through using the parliament and through finding new examples. I think one of the real problems for the government is that there is opportunity to push the story forward through finding example after example of companies that got it when their profits went up, or of welfare recipients who are being pursued for tiny debts, and making that comparison. So there's numbers of ways that the story can be kept alive, even though the government is sort of hoping that we'll, you know, run out of angles, run out of ways of pursuing it, and that it will all die down. If I had to guess, I think this is one of those stories where they're not really going to be able to weather the storm because the inequity is so egregious, and there are ways of kind of continuing to find new avenues to pursue the story.
goes to a wider question that will probably shape the next federal election, which is which bits of the pandemic do people remember? Which bits are salient when they come to voting? Mm. Do they remember that JobKeeper saved their job potentially and kept them, you know, kept them afloat in the worst days of last year? Or do they remember the inequities that we've just been discussing?
Next, turning over a new green leaf and a dying star. Let's move on to what we can't get out of our head. Lenore, what captured your attention this week?
So my story actually started in the Nine newspapers where they were trumpeting a new plan by News Corp that it was going to apparently end its editorial hostility towards carbon reduction policies and advocate for the world's leading economies to hit net zero emissions by 2050, and that this was going to start in mid-October. It was going to be a company-wide campaign heading into the Glasgow COP26 summit later this year, which sounds like a terrific thing, right? I mean, News Corp's overt campaigning has contributed greatly to the fact that Australia hasn't been able to find a climate policy that made any sense for about a decade. Mm. The only problem from my point of view is that there's not much evidence that the plan exists yet. There's been plenty of op-eds, for example, in the last week, excoriating a special advisor on climate action to the UN Secretary General for repeating what the UN Secretary General had said 6 months ago, which is that OECD countries should phase out coal by 2030. This continues to be a source of astonishment, amusement, and horror to many News Corp columnists. And I was particularly taken by a panel on Sky News with Matt Canavan, Joel Fitzgibbon and Rowan Dean, who all thought that we should just keep mining coal indefinitely and get out of the UN instead and that that would solve the problem. And Dean offered the blinding insight that Boris Johnson is really only pushing for a strong climate outcome from COP26 because he is now married to, and I quote, a green woke Sheila. So before anyone gets too carried away, I would recommend Graham Redfern's analysis on this topic. I'd certainly welcome it if News Corp were turning over a new green leaf, but I haven't seen any evidence of it yet.
In short, you're sceptical,
though. A little bit.
Mike, what was it that you couldn't get out of your head this week?
So my favourite piece this week was one we published about the Melbourne Star observation wheel, and it's the end of its checkered life. I'm not from Melbourne, so I wasn't previously terribly aware of this thing that has been in the Docklands area of Melbourne for some years, but I would very highly recommend Toby's piece because it's extremely funny. I'll just read the first line of it, which says, "The Melbourne Star Observation Wheel peacefully completed her final rotation on Monday, the 6th of September, 2021, surrounded by friends, family and the Costco store, following a brave battle with pretty much everything." And it goes on to detail the many you know, misfortunes that occurred to the observation wheel during its short and quite unhappy life.
It sort of started in that point where every city needed a wheel, right?
Yeah.
It was not a terribly successful wheel, but it's a very funny piece, and I think it cheered me up in a week of, another week of grim news.
Me too. Actually, when I was reading it, I realised that I hadn't laughed out loud like that for all week, so it was delightful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Lenore.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Gabs.
This episode was produced by Miles Herbert, Camilla Hannan and Karishma Luthria. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. Tomorrow, when you dip into your full story feed, you'll find a nice little surprise. Acclaimed author Thomas Keneally reading his own essay on Australia's fractured federation. It's the debut episode of Australia Reads. It's a thought-provoking listen and introduced by Lenore Taylor. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. That's it for today. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday, and we'll see you then.